Okay, good evening. We're going to begin quickly chazering the Mishnah that we began last week. We didn't actually finish it. We're going to tonight. We're on Nun Hei Amud Beis, the beginning of Perek HaKones. And the Mishnah begins by telling us that one who brings the Tzon Ladir, HaKones Tzon Ladir, we explained last week in the name of the Meiri that the deer is a special temporary enclosure that is set up for the purpose of fertilizing the particular section of the field. So a person brings his tzon into that area, v'nol v'poneho karoi, and he locks them in karoi, meaning in a sufficient fashion. And tonight, the first question the Gemara is going to deal with is try to arrive at a clear definition as to what karoi means. The Yatzav Yizikah, the animals then somehow escape. It's not clear yet how, and it's not clear that it even matters why, but somehow the animals break away and manage to escape that enclosure, the Yizikah, and then subsequently cause damage, let's say by eating in the neighbor's field. So the din is pater. As Rashi said, the Balabais is pater because essentially he did all that was expected of him, the Hanatra, who might have a little nevad. There's nothing more that we require of him to do. So since he took all necessary precautions, we view this as being an unfortunate accident, and we do not hold him responsible. If, however, he did not close them in a sufficient manner, and if there was any shmira, so it was considered to be an inferior shmira that did not meet the necessary standards, and then v'yatzav hizikah, so then he's going to be chayv. The Mishnah then continues, Nifetz of Alayla, Osha Partzua, Listim, Miyatzav, Yizika Patzah. The Mishnah then gives two other examples of how an enclosure that was, how the animals that were enclosed can get out. Either there's some pirsa that takes place at night, or Listim, robbers come in and they break open the fence, and the animals escape. So then here as well, being that the enclosure was closed karoi, so then he's going to be potter. However, hotzi'ua listim chayavin. If, however, the listim take the animals out, and as I said, we're going to hold off till we get to Nunvava Mebeis, and we'll see the machlokas rishonim there as to whether or not the listim try taking the animals, or for the purpose of stealing them, or merely, you know, pull them out of there. We're going to see whether or not that matters, but either way, in this case, the listim now assume the responsibility for any damage that would take place by the eating of the animals. The last point we learned last week is hinicha b'chama. Oh, shemasra l'cheshad v'katam v'yatzav v'zika chayiv. The Mishnah gives two other examples where, despite the fact that the animals may have been left in the deer and it was closed karoi, because of the fact that there were other circumstances, mitigating factors, so he's now going to be chayev. So the first example that's given here is hinicha b'chama, that if the animals were placed in the heat and the sun, and Rashi says, metzara lo shimsha, the discomfort that is caused by the animals being directly in the sun without any shade, causes them to now become more aggressive and trying to escape in order to find some comfort, some shade. So lo sagila ben ilas karoi. So now, says Rashi, the precautions that were considered to be acceptable and sufficient in the ratio of the Mishnah are no longer acceptable, because now there's an external factor, namely the sun, which is causing the animals to escape. And the Gemara is going to explain, you have to assume that the animal is going to try whatever he can to escape. Similarly, in a different case, if he gives the animals over to Rechesha the Vekatan for the purpose of watching them, and then the animals escape, he's going to be chayv here as well. The idea being that each of these individuals are not considered to be B'nei Das. By halachic standards, they are not considered to be individuals who can assume the necessary responsibility in order to absolve someone who is considered to be a shomer, the balabais, or someone else, of all liability. And so therefore, if I am entrusted, either if I'm the owner or if I'm entrusted with somebody else's animals or property, the only way I can walk away from that is if I give it to someone else who is considered to be an acceptable shomer. Cheshav v'katam do not meet those standards. Masra l'roeh, nichnas l'roeh tachtov. Let's say the animals are given over to a shepherd. So if they're given over to another shepherd, so then nichnas haroa tachtov. What does that mean? We didn't see this last week. Nichnas haroa tachtov, the roa, the shepherd, now literally enters the place of him, of tachtov. So who's the tachtov? So one of the questions the Gemara is going to ask later is tachtov the man. Whose place is he taking? The Gemara assumes that the Mishnah does not seem to be taking, to be saying that which it appears on the surface to be saying, namely that if the owner gives it over to a shepherd, that the shepherd takes place of the owner. That's an obvious point that we've already learned earlier. So the Gemara assumes that what the Mishnah is saying over here is that if the Balabayas is going away on vacation and he gives his animals to a roa, and then the roa needs to take a break, the shepherd, he, for whatever reason, has to go somewhere else. He has to take a break. He can't remain in charge of these animals. And he gives it to another roa. So then, nichnas haroa tachtov, so roa B now takes the place of roa A. So that's, again, something we'll discuss in more detail in the Gemara. But on the simple level right now, that's what the Mishnah seems to be saying. The last point in the Mishnah, it talks about somewhat of an unusual case over here. And that is, what happens if nafla legina v'nehanes? What does nafla legina mean? So Rashi says, nafla legina, which literally means an animal falls into a garden. Now, how does an animal fall into a garden? Right? Unless he was being transported on a plane. Wait, what did you say? Well, that's okay.
And
on a roof, right? Rashi gives two examples. Ba'ones, he fell. Either migag, migag baila, he was on the roof of his owner, and it was selach leginas chaveiro. So there were two properties adjacent, and the house was adjacent to the property of the owner, so therefore when the animal accidentally lost his balance, whatever it is, it fell off, so he lands in Gan Eden. He lands in the neighbor's... What's he doing on the roof? He's sunbathing.
A sheep can jump up on there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's all the shorter
yeah, it could be... Fence. Right. Not necessarily, you know, a 12-foot roof. He's wherever he is. He's the point is he's on an elevated area. The Gemara is the reason why Rashi says this. Obviously, Rashi tried to explain the metzius of nafla. If it's a flat surface, it's hard to explain how the animal accidentally fall into the neighbor's property. So therefore, Rashi says either we're talking about a case where it was on an elevated area, such as a gag, or osha hayis rishus rabim gavoa min hagina. In other cases, could be that the animals were being led through the Rishus HaRabim, which is totally acceptable. The shepherd or the owner is leading his sheep through the street, but the side of the street was elevated, and one of the animals lost his balance, and he fell down a little hill, and where does he land? He lands Beginas Chaveiro on someone else's garden. And as soon as he lands there, so he opens his eyes, and ooh, beautiful, you know, lunch. So if that's what happens, and then v'nehanes, and then the animal gets hana, so then mishalem es mashenehanes. So then the owner has to pay for hana. I'm going to explain this in a moment. Let's just read one more line, and we'll come back to this. Yarda kedarka b'hizika. However, let's say the animal didn't fall, but rather it was yored kedarka, meaning it walked. It knowingly, intentionally, found his way into the neighbor's field, i.e., he was not being guarded properly, and then v'hizika causes damage, mishalemis masha hazika. So the question is, what's the difference between v'nehanes or hana and v'hizika? Oh, very, 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 very interesting you should say that, because the Gemara later on is going to suggest that the different ways of different types of hana, and it seemed that the Parshat Pshat Mishnah is talking about achila, but actually Rav is going to suggest that it could be talking about that case where the flowers cushion the fall, so it's really wild till we get there. But before we get to the exact circumstances as to how what exactly the hana was, is a more important distinction over here, and this is one that we discussed earlier. We have not seen this concept since the second parak, certainly discussed over there in the second parak. Could it be that it's come up since? I don't remember. But in the second parak, the Mishnahis talk about this difference between hana and hezek, a very, very important concept which we're just going to reflect upon briefly, and that is of course, it's a given already that the Torah holds a person responsible for different types of hezek. So we have, again, shor, bor, mave, hever, all the different situations where a person is responsible for damages that either he causes directly or that are caused by his property. That's called hezek. There are times where my property, or I, perhaps, can be responsible for having damaged someone else, but technically, because of the circumstances, I'm not considered a mazik. So the reality is you've been damaged, but I'm not guilty. Which means, you know, as far as you're concerned, the nizak, the one who's been damaged, doesn't really care, because he's still out $50. But whereas in the first case, where I'm considered a mazik, I have to pay you. The Torah imposes responsibility upon me to make you whole. In a situation where I'm off the hook, either because I didn't do anything wrong or on technical grounds, so then I'm not considered a mazik. However, even in that situation, there is still the possibility that a person would have to pay what's called hana. And hana means benefit, meaning, and I think that this is the definition in terms of the way we've learned it in the past, the Torah always holds me responsible to pay for benefit that I received at your expense. Again, even if I'm not a mazik, the Torah, there's no such thing as a free lunch, or at least not if it's coming from your pocket. So the Torah says that even though I'm technically not a mazik, I'm not a damager, I'm not guilty, I haven't done anything wrong, but if I've benefited at your expense, I have to pay you. So what's the difference then between hana and hezek? So there's a very important difference between hana and hezek. What's the difference? So how much do you pay? So how much do you have to pay for hezek, for damage? Whatever the damage is, doesn't matter, right? There are situations where you pay chatzi nezek, but generally speaking, you just have to assess the damage, and that's what you pay. That's nezek. When it comes to hana, that's not necessarily the case. The hana is the value that the owner received, which may be less. So, for example, if my animal goes into your field and he eats very, very expensive flowers, right? Roses that you could have sold for $100. So now you've lost $100 worth of roses. Now what hana did I receive? I received the following hana. I don't have to feed my animal lunch. Right? Now he doesn't need lunch. What do I normally feed him for lunch? I don't give him roses. I give him hay, which costs me $5. So I have to pay you $5 because that's the benefit that I received. I don't have to give my animal lunch today. But I don't have to pay you hezek because I'm not a mazik. So very interesting, the Mishnah says over here, if my animal falls into your garden, so then I'm not a mazik. I haven't done anything wrong. The idea being, as Rashi says, key words, it was an onus. It was an accident that happened suddenly, and actually Gemara here as well later on is going to say, well, how did this happen? Why did the owner not anticipate that the animal was going to fall? So the Gemara is going to discuss the circumstances. But let's assume for a moment situations do come up where it was a real bona fide accident. It was an onus. So there's no question I'm not responsible. But the fact of the matter is, by the time we fish my animal out of there, he no longer needs to be fed lunch. So, you know, it's money in my pocket. So that I have to pay. So that's why the Mishnah says, Nafla l'gina v'nehenes, so then mishalem is mashenenes, you have to pay for the hana. However, yarder kedarka, if the animal wanders his way, kedarka, meaning there was some negligence on the part of the shomer, whoever was watching it, the owner, the shepherd, etc., and then the animal causes hezek. Again, the verb, the truth of the matter is, you know, the metzias is the same. The animal ate in both cases. But in one case, we say v'nanis, because there was no real hezek. In the other case, we say v'hezika. So then, mishalem is masha hezika. So there's a big difference over here in terms of how much he's going to have to pay. Rashi says, v'masha nanis, l'fi ha'nasa, v'lo l'fi hezeka. Basically, you pay in accordance, whatever the value of the hana is, but not the value of the hezek. I don't think you can come up with a situation where the hana would exceed the value of the hezek. That wouldn't make any sense. Right? In other words, the hana will always be less than the hezek, because the hezek, by definition, you know, if you get paid in the hezek already.
Feed your animal. It's a thoroughbred. You only give this animal the best food because it's a thoroughbred, and the animal goes ahead and eats barley.
Yes.
So you can't feed the animal lunch because they already ate the barley, so they're missing out on lunch.
So I have to pay you And it doesn't make sense, right? The guy, he ate the barley, so the barley, the bill comes to $10. So I have to pay you the amount of money that I would normally, I get my horse sushi. So I have to pay you, right? That doesn't make sense. It can't be that you ever have to pay more than the actual damage. And in most situations, I understand we're stretching that and trying to come up with one. Most cases, anyway, the hana is going to be less than the hezek. But you never have to pay more than the nezek. The idea being, the nezek would be, you know, the maximum. That's the dollar amount of the damage.
Are you asking for a situation where it could be?
Right. Right. In mitzias, there could be a case where my animal is full and... Right, but again, correct.
But it could be related to things that are not related to animals. It could be other kind of damages, like property.
Correct.
Even in modern times, expensive instruments and things like
that. Right. This relates to another sugya which I'm not going to talk about right now, but it's a famous sugya in Bava Metzia. It may come up elsewhere as well, but the main sugya is Bava Metzia, which the concept about Yored, that if a person, let's say, without being asked, without being solicited, you know, does a service for his neighbor... at a certain expense, it could be that he could send him a bill for that. So it doesn't mean it's mutar l'chachila for him to do.
Lunch is very small. It's always going to be small.
Right.
Because what do they eat?
Right. That's when it comes to animals. But I'm saying, there's what to talk about. If you come home one day and discover that I mowed your lawn, and you didn't ask me to do it, could very well be that I can bill you for that.
I go to pay for work that I had had a quantum merit. But it means that once I have the hana, it serves to be good for me, and so I'll get it to pay you regardless of whatever contract it is or not.
Right.
So it's the same concept.
Right. Okay. So that's the concept of the paying for hana. How much do you pay? So the last point the Mishnah discusses is Ketzad Mishalemis Masha Hezika. So how do you evaluate this damage? So that's a silly question. It should be pretty simple. So just a little background over here why it's not so simple. And we can read the Mishnah's answer. Shamin beis sa'a ba'osa dachsadeh kam hayasa yafeh v'kam hi yafeh. Which literally means we evaluate a beis sa'a, which is, let's say for argument's sake, it's not, but let's say it's like an acre. It's a certain amount of, it's a actual measure, which was very commonly used to determine, you know, to speak in terms of the actual size of a field. So a beis sa'a, which I think I saw brought down was 2,500 or maybe 250, 2,500 square amos. So they brought down to give you a sense of it's a nice chunk of field. So a beis sa'a. So what we do is we evaluate what a beis sa'a of this quality of field would have sold before and after the damage. What does that mean? So let's take a Rashi over here. He's very clear in terms of explaining what's going on in the Mishnah. Rashi, Shamin beis sa'a ba'osa sa'a. Says Rashi, Ein Shamin is haruga levada. In most situations when we evaluate damage, so we just look at the goods that were lost, and we figure out what they were worth, and that's what you pay. But over here, when an animal eats a row, let's say, of fruit or vegetables or something that was growing in a field, we do not assess the actual value of the aruga, which means the row of vegetables that were eaten. Bipnei shemafsid mazik. Because what this is really going to do, it's really going to cause perhaps too much of a hardship, too much of a loss on the mazik. Again, interestingly, we're looking to keep this fair and balanced. And of course, the mazik has to pay the nizak, but we don't want to be too hard on the mazik. And we're not going to make him shishamna sabachol shavye. We're not going to assess it at its complete value. Rather, why? Because Rachmana Amar, the Torah says, ubier b'stei acher, and this is a drasha the Gemara is going to teach later. Which means that when we evaluate, we look at another field. So what do we do? So the Mishnah, so Rashi explains, Shamin beis sa'a ba'osa sa'a, kama hayisa yafa kodem shenachla mimena haruga hazos. V'kama yafa achshav. We go ahead, we call in a real estate agent, and we say, if we wanted to sell a beis sa'a of this grade field, so what would it go for? So this is it'll sell for $1,000. And what about if it was missing this one row? Then it'll sell for $990. Okay, so you know that the damage was $10. Dameha. Now you're not paying the full value, because if you would have calculated how much food, if we would have taken that aruga, gone to the shuk, it would have gone for $20. But we don't make him pay $20. The Misha Lokeach Beisa, Kashihi Betsuwasa, Enam Zalza Babashil Hesed Aruga Achas Kim Devar Muad. Because the reality is, when somebody buys a whole big field of, a big piece of field, it's not, he's not going to be mezalzel so much. In other words, he's not going to be concerned or try to get such a cheaper price, because there happens to be one row that's missing, one row that's ruined, that's spoiled. So, in order to be fair to both the mazik and the nizak, when we evaluate an aruga b'soch hasodeh, we imagine as if this was one aruga with one big beisa. And by the way, this would apply even if there was an actual beisa property over here. It doesn't mean that there has to be a beisa, but it means we look at this aruga as if it were part of a beisa, and then we what? We subtract the value of what the beisa would be worth missing this aruga from the amount that it would have been worth prior to the damage. Yeah.
Talking about produce that is fully ripe and ready to be picked, or stuff that's still in the growing process, and ultimately it's not really something that you would pick at this time.
Right. So either you have Ruach HaKodesh, I can't imagine looked on, because you didn't look on because you wouldn't ask a question. So your question is right on the mark, because we're talking about, the Tanakhama would seem to say that this applies in every situation. But Rabbi Shimon says, the last position in the Mishnah is, Rabbi Shimon says, Ochle Peres Gemurim, if what we're eating were actual Peres Gemurim, says Rashi Shekvar Bishlu Kol Tzarchon, which means they are fully ripened, ready to be sold, so then Mishalem is Peres Gemurim. So then, that's what you pay. Rashi says, Kol HaHezek, Behechash Shemina Nagav Sadeh, Behechash Adayim Lo Nigmaru. When is it, says Rabbi Shimon, that we look at the value of the entire Sadeh? That's if they're not yet fully ripened. But Rabbi Shimon says, no. If you eat Peres Gemurim, you pay for what they're worth. Im Sa Sayim, whatever it is. If it's one Sa, if it's two Sa, that's what you pay. So there's a Machlokas Tanaim here in the Mishnah. The Tanakhama says, we don't make any distinction. We say that whenever produce is what's eaten, so then we take it, we evaluate the produce within the greater sale of the, the theoretical sale of the field. Whereas Rabbi Shimon says, not if we're dealing with fully ripened fruit. Fully ripened fruit already are treated as if they are not batel to the karka. They're viewed as if they're what? Almost like separate entities. Even if technically they were still mechubel karka, they were still attached at the time of the hezek, we view them as if they are peiros that were eaten from a basket in the house.
Because they could have been harvested.
Right, I guess that's the idea. That's Rav Shimon's idea already.
He didn't get around to it yet,
but correct.
I was curious, does this seem to assume or talking about, farms where it's a commercial thing, where, in other words, I'm trying to think of a case where it's a very small property, it's a garden, let's say, and people live there, this is where they grow their vegetables that they eat all winter.
Right.
Is that the same thing as this? Would it also be subject to this kind of
cycle? It seems that we're saying this across the board. It seems that we, because the Gemara is going to actually ask another question. The Gemara says, okay, very nice. So you evaluate the aruga b'sof beisa. How do you come up with the value of a beisa? In other words, a beisa is going to be worth more if you buy one beisa, but if you're going to buy, let's say, 100 beisa, so each beisa is going to be worth less. So the Gemara comes up with actual formulas. And Gemara's conclusion is, we evaluate the value of this beisa as if it was being sold within 60. As if you were selling 60 sa. So it seems somewhat, I don't want to say completely random or arbitrary, it would seem that the Tanoim came up with a standard which seemed to conform to that which they considered at the time to be an appropriate, fair, almost compromise between the the interest of the mazik and the nizak. We don't want to, again, what's really driving this is gzeiras hakasef. It's not that, Chazal stepped in and said, why? It's not that he said, let's be nice to the mazik. What's really driving this is the Torah says, you'll be able to stay after. So we know we need to be looking at another karka. Okay, so this, but in terms of the ultimate goal over here, so as Rashi says over here, we're looking to be fair and not, make the mazik pay more than he would need to. Because after all, you could look at it as if it's $20 worth of fruit that was eaten. Or you could say, look, it's a big piece of property, so one row was eaten, but the property overall wasn't damaged all that much.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's a little different.
It's worth more to them. Right. It seems that it's a low plug. I don't think we make any distinction over here. Right, because Rashi says, the Mishnah says, Shaman Beisa Ba'osa Sadeh, means that this Sadeh doesn't have to be a Beisa. We just evaluate a Beisa of this grade, of this type of this type of field. Okay. Alright, so now we're going to begin the Gemara. And the Gemara begins by quoting a Braisa, which of course relates back to the first statement in the Mishnah. The Mishnah used, again, a very ambiguous expression, a term that really requires some clarification, karoi. So, right? Hakonis silna dieva nalba fanel karoi. As I said last week, it's like a parent, you said to your child, I'm going out, be good. I mean, be good doesn't mean anything unless, you know, let's come up with a very clear definition as to what good means. So what does it mean, v'nalba fanel karoi? Karoi what? So Tan Rabbanan ezel karoi, ve'ezel shalo karoi. What is considered karoi and what's not? So the Gemara answers, the Braisa says, deles. Pretty simple answer. A door that could withstand a ruach matsuya, which means doesn't mean an average wind, but it means an expected wind, that which is to be expected at such a time and such a place. So that's called a koroi. If the delet cannot even withstand a ruach matsuya, meaning right now it's closed, but if a little breeze comes, it's going to knock the door open. So that's called shalokaroi. Now, I had a technical difficulty in printing the sheet. I had a few marmakomos that I prepared, and I wasn't able to print it. But the marshal, which I think actually was on last week's sheet, it was one of the last marmakomos, the marshal just says one very important line over here. And that is that you shouldn't think, says the marshal, that this has really any, that this is limited to a deles, or it's limited to a wind. When we speak about a ruach matsuya, ruach she'ena matsuya, we're talking about a deles, these are examples. What the Braisa is really teaching over here is that the word karoi means that we expect in this situation that the shomer, again, either the owner or the shepherd, whoever has been entrusted with watching these animals, do what? Do a shmira which would prevent damage in a normal expected situation. Right. Let me see. They have the sheet from last week. If you still have it, fine. If not, it happens to be the end of source number 5. The Amshal Shlomo says, "Vizel klau." Well, actually, one learned line up. He says, "V'lav davka b'ruach karmar." When it says over here ruach, it doesn't mean necessarily ruach wind. Ela ba'omed b'shmira beinonis masharinam. Rather, it says we're looking for an average type of shmira. She'ena me'ula. It doesn't have to be a superior. We call a gavaldik shmira. No. Doesn't have to be that. Anything which is to be expected, which is common, that's called a ruach matsuya. But something that would only perhaps get damaged if some unusual occurrence would take place, that's called a ruach she'en matsuya, upata. Another term which we're going to be introduced to very shortly in the Gemara is what's called Shmira Pachusa and Shmira Ulu. We might as well just use these terms right now because it's really the very next piece in the Gemara. A Shmira Pachusa, which would mean an inferior type of a Shmira, but it would actually be, we're going to see, it actually is what we're calling over here Karoi. It doesn't mean you did the best job possible, but you watched it on a inferior sort of level, and a higher, more substantial type of shmira is called a shmira ma'ula. Obviously, there's still a very these are very subjective terms, and it's up to dayanim in any particular time or place to determine whether or not something is considered a ruach matsuya or not. But at least we should realize that we're not talking about only winds or doors, but the idea is that which is shchiach versus that which is not shchiach. So according to the Bryce's presentation over here, if we plug it back into our mission, what our mission is basically saying is that when it comes to protecting your neighbor from damage that would perhaps be caused by your tzon, all you have to do is a what? A shmir pachusa. All you have to do is a karoi shmir, which is, I don't know, is that surprising or not? It's not on the highest level. So why is it that you don't have to do more? You don't have to do more because at the end of the day, Chances are nothing will happen. Right, and we're not talking over here about an animal that is naturally aggressive. It's true that if you put him right in front of food, he's probably going to eat. But if you give him a space and you close the door and it's not likely to blow open in the wind, then in all likelihood the situation would be fine. Now the Gemara is still going to be bothered by this, and the Gemara is going to want to find a raya. Where do we come up with such a thing? Ultimately, the Gemara is going to show that the source is from the Torah itself. The Gemara is going to blame it on a pasuk, because it's still logically it should perhaps bother us. You know, if you own animals, you know the onus upon you to try to take every precaution. So the Gemara ultimately is going to say no. We're going to see that there's a basis for this from the pasuk itself. But what we're saying is that a shmir pechus is sufficient. Which is actually a lead in to the Negemari's next question. Amr of Mani Bar Patish. Mani Bar Patish asks the following question. Man Tana Muad Desogi Lei B'Shmir Pechusa. Who is the Tana that says a Muad, that it's sufficient to guard a Muad with a Shmir Pechusa? So here as well, it would be a good time to just review and reintroduce those who are new the concept of Muad. Muad we typically use almost in every situation in reference to a shore. We've spoken about a shor tam and a shor muad. Shor tam means a shor that has not shown a tendency to be aggressive, to be violent in any way, and it's more or less a tame shor. You know, I always tell my students that's the way they can remember tam. Means it's very similar to the word tame. Okay, good. So it's a tame ox. Shor muad already is an animal that has what? Shown a certain propensity to damage, and it's demonstrated this in specific ways. There are certain halachos, how a shor becomes a shor muad. Basically, you know, it establishes what we call a chazaka, doing something three times, and once we've identified a certain predictable pattern, so then we label the animals a shor muad. So muad basically means, in Bava Kamma, in a more general sense, muad means damage that is to be expected. So by a shor, you could speak about keren muad. When you're talking about son over here, we're not talking about carrion, we're not talking about an animal that's goring, but an animal's tendency to eat is considered a muad behavior. It's at its own, like most animals, if you put food in front of it, it's going to eat. So we're assuming right now that the tendency for its own to eat food, whether it's theirs or not, its own don't really know, and they're not interested in making that determination. So the assumption is that if you put food in front of its own, it's going to eat. So the Gemara wants to know then that man tana muad sogi lebshmir pechusa. Who then is the tana that says such a thing that when it comes to a behavior that is considered muad, it's enough to just do a shmir pechusa, which we've already defined as an inferior grade shmirah. Says Rashi, money must nisin. What Rav Mani Bar Patish is really asking is who was the author of our Mishnah, the Omar, who seems to say that son shezika b'shem v'regel, that son that damaged by either eating or knocking into things, the hain muad b'tchilaso, which is obviously behavior which is assumed to do from the very beginning, even if it hasn't established the pattern beforehand, that's what animals do. But yet sagile b'neila karoi, the hain shmir b'chusa, but yet it seems to be sufficient to just guard it with a quote unquote shmira karoi, a neila karoi, which is a shmir b'chusa. To the kin, as we said already, that if a Rosh Hashanah comes, it will not hold up, but yet according to the Tanar Mishnah, that's sufficient.
What's the relationship between the status of Moors with the quality of the Shmira? Now, the thing that's sown, it's going to eat, fixed, but it likes to eat more than another sheep. So it doesn't mean it's more likely to get out.
Right. So I just want to clarify that the Gemara over here is not objecting to anything yet, and the Gemara is not attacking anyone. This is really a setup of sorts because we already have, as we're going to see right now, we have a machlokes tanoim we've introduced previously, which talks about what type of shmir is necessary for an animal that is considered a muad. So
no, I said that, but the Gemara seems to be drawing the connection between the status of muad and the quality of the shmir.
Right.
So my question is, why would a trimmer shore, let's say, the quality shore seems to be really foreseeability, right?
Mm-hmm.
Foresee that there'll be a hurricane wind or not. It's not that you have to worry about it. But if the damage that the behemoth is likely to do is to eat my neighbor's rose bushes, then how well the door is locked is irrelevant, right? Because once he gets out, it'll eat more, maybe. But
what do you mean, eat more? He can't eat any if the door's closed.
Sorry, I know. Well, when it comes to how well I have to lock the door, close the door, latch the
door. Right.
What difference does it make if the animal is...
Well, because if let's say if we're talking about an animal that's not moored, so even if the door swings open, so what? The animal's still not likely to do anything. So it's just one...
It's likely to swing open when?
Whenever. What do you mean when?
Well, you're saying if it's a tom, it's enough.
We're saying all sheep are moored.
We're saying, correct. All sheep... Right, so I just want to rush through this quickly before, so forgive me, but when it comes to a shore, so we speak about shore tom or shore moored, because over there we're talking about a particular behavior that is not natural for an average animal to do. Right? The conclusion of the Gemara is that that shor ches, this is again not the sugya, but what's the lashon, right? The shor v'cheskas lav, gosh, I remember the expression, but basically v'cheskas shamor koi, I forgot the expression, I was told. Anyway, the assumption we make is that a shor normally is a mensch. A shor is not going to go out of going. That's the right? And if something happens, okay, it happens. If it happens again, we watch it. If it happens three times already, that's it. So this shor is the exception to the rule, and we call him a shor mu'ud. But mu'ud really means, at its core, it just means something that we could expect to predict. So when it comes to Karen, by definition, that's unusual, so it applies to a specific shor. But as you remember, the Mishnah earlier in the Masechta that says, if you have a snake, he's mu'ud b'tchilah. So if you have a lion, he's mu'ud b'tchilah. So you don't have to wait for him to kill three times to say, oh, he's mu'ud. So tzon are mu'ud to eat, says Rashi. The mu'ud when it comes to shein v'reil. That's what they do. Unless it's a sick sheep, he's going to walk around eating and knocking into things all day. That's what they were born to do. So that's what it means. So, of course, the correlation between the likelihood of the door swinging open and what's going to happen afterwards is very important. Right? Because if nothing is going
to
happen afterwards...
Expected behavior.
Right.
You have to prepare for expected behavior.
Right. No, that's correct. So the question is, when the guy goes to sleep at night... Did he take appropriate measures, precautions, to avoid having his neighbor become, become damaged? So clearly, our Mishnah states that even when it comes to damage which is brought about by a muad damage, expected damage, still shmir b'chus is sufficient. So the Gemara wants to know who is the Tana that says such a thing. So the Gemara says, well, it's Rabbi Yehuda. How do you know that? So now we're going to be introduced to a Mishnah, which appeared earlier in the Masechta, which has three opinions of the Tanaim regarding a shor. Now again, I want to warn you, it's a little different because, sometimes it doesn't make a difference. An animal is an animal. But being that we're shifting now, we're not talking about eating, but we're talking about an ox goring. So you have to realize that because the case in the Mishnah is a little different. The Tanan, the Mishnah says the following. If you have a shor and you want to prevent it from goring, another shor goring another person, property, whatever it is. So, shoro balav vimoseira, which means if the owner tied the shor down with the moseira. Moseira is like a leash. It's a rope, but it is not a heavy metal chain. And you'll see in a moment why I'm saying that, but it's a tie. It does something. Or I know it says v'no'al, but this really is to be understood as of o no'al l'fanav karoi. Or if the owner just closes the animal in and doesn't do anything else, v'yatzav hizik, then the animal gets out and he gores. So echad tam echad muad chayev divir v'meir. Rameyer says it doesn't really matter whether or not the animal is a shor tam or shor muad. At that point, we hold the owner responsible. Why? So what does Rameyer clearly hold? That when it comes to a shor, that a shmir pachusa is not sufficient. It's not good. You need something more than that. And it has nothing to do, by the way, with whether it's tam or muad. Because it's clearly, if it's a shor tam, of course, by a shor tam, you're only going to have to pay half chatzinezik. But still, you have to pay. You can't say it's an ones. How was I supposed to know this is going to happen? That's Rameyer. The Yehuda says, now don't throw anything at me, because I'm going to tell you the Meiri, so please don't throw anything, I'm asking you. Rabbi Yehuda says, tam, if it's a short tam, meaning it's never done this before, so then you're chayef, then you have to pay. If it's a muad, then you're positive. Okay, so...
Wait.
Just make sure everybody's still awake. So good, thank God. You all had the appropriate reactions. This is not a Talos Sofer. We're going to explain in a moment. Rabbi Yehuda says something very strange. Again, if the Shor had never done this before, or it's a short time, so then the owner is responsible because he didn't do enough. If, however, it's a Muad, so then he's Pater. Where does he get this from? Shenemar, so he quotes a Pasuk, still not going to satisfy us yet. Shenemar, the Pasuk says, V'lo yishmerenu balav. Pasuk, when talking about a Shor Muad, says, and the owner didn't watch it. However, Rabbi Huda says, V'shamar huze, at the end of the day, he did a Shmira. Rabbi Huda's understanding of the Pasuk is, and it's a unique understanding, because the two other Tanaim disagree with him, is that when it comes to a Shor Muad, you have to do a Shmira, but it doesn't have to be a superior Shmira. Even a Shmira Pechusa is sufficient. Asks them eerie, and I'm just going to stick it in here to put out of your misery. Where's the logic in that? Does that make any sense? So again, you could say Gzeres HaKasev, which means sometimes we just submit to the will of the Lord and we don't understand why. However, the Meiri, you want to say something? Go ahead.
What is it?
What is it? On my sheet tonight, I did have the Pesukim, and I'm sorry that I wasn't successful in copying it. But the Pesukim in Parshat Mishpatim, which may be brought down to the footnotes over there, the whole Pesuk, or maybe even on the art school, may even be on the side of the Gemara itself. I think they bring down the Pesukim. The Pesuk says, I'll read it to you. The Pesuk says, Oh no da. This is a Pesuk from Perek Chaf Aleph in Sefer Shemos, Parshat Mishpatim. Oh no da, kishon naga chumit moshe shom. But if it is known that what? The shor has gored previously. V'lo yishmeranu balav. And the owners did not watch it. So then, shalem yishalem shor tachas ha-shor v'hamesi elo. So then you have to pay what we call nezek shalem, etc. So Rabbi Yehuda says, what does it say in the Pesuk? It says, the owner has to pay because he didn't watch it. So says Rabbi Yehuda, What does it mean? It means he has to do a Shmira. But even a Shmira Pechusa is sufficient. That doesn't have to be a superior Shmira. Now again, but why does that make any sense? How could it be that we hold the owner of a Shor Tam to a greater degree of liability than the owner of a Shor Mu'ud? It doesn't make any sense. So the Meiri explains, and it's interesting that there aren't too many Rishonim that even touch on this, but the Meiri says that a Shor Mu'ud, and actually this point, the first point the Meiri makes is clear from the Gemara and other places, that when you have a Shor Mu'ud, it's public knowledge. Everybody knows that this guy Shor is has been acting up the last few days. Because again, for a Shor to become a Shor Mu'ud, it requires a process in Bezdin, where the owner is brought to Bezdin and he's warned three separate occasions. It's a whole process. So by the time the Shor becomes labeled a Shor Mu'ud, everybody knows, watch out for the Shor. So says the Meiri, that's why only all that's necessary is Shmir Pechusa, because to a certain degree we hold the victim responsible as well. The victim should have watched out. Good.
Too bad.
Right. In other words, you knew that this shore was up to trouble. You knew that there was a problem with it already. So what business did you have bringing your shore walking right next to it? You should have walked across the street. You brought him up close. Okay, so we still hold the owner responsible if he didn't do a Shmir. But a Shmir Pechusa is enough, because everybody else is supposed to know to stay away. Now again, if you don't like the Shita, that's fine. I mean, again, because there are two other Tanaim that agree with Yehuda, and I could live with people being, you know, still a little shocked by this, but the Meiri certainly takes the edge of the shock a little bit, because it explains that there is a logic to this. There is a logic that a short time, the neighbors don't know anything about the Shor, so therefore you have to do a little more. But if a Shor Mu'ud, a Shmir Pechis is enough. By the way, what we just saw, that Rabbi Yehuda holds that if for a Mu'ud, Shmir Pechus is sufficient. So just hold that thought. Rabbi Yezer says, it's a very fascinating expression, Elo Shmira Elo Sakin. Which means the only way to watch it is with a knife. What does that mean? It means if you have a Shor Mu'ud, you're going to be responsible whatever happens. You don't want to be responsible, you know what you got to do? Eat it. Shecht it. Enjoy it, have a good meal, and get over it. But if you want to keep it alive, that's your choice. But if something goes wrong, it's your problem. In other words, says Rabbi Eliezer, even a Shmira Ma'ula, even if you chain the animal down, it's not enough. Basically, Rabbi Eliezer is really saying, you have no right having a Shor Mu'ud. Once the animal's been promoted to the level of becoming a Shor Mu'ud, so then really it's your responsibility to put it to sleep. Because it's dangerous. And if you keep it, and something goes wrong, so you're going to hold you responsible. You perhaps, Rabbi Eliezer says, you're in violation of a Torah prohibition, of Lo Sasim Dam V'Vei Secho, you're not permitted to have hazardous things around your home. You can't have a broken ladder. You can't have holes around the floor. You can't have nails on the floor. You can't have a shor mu'ud and just keep them there. So ain lo shmir ala sakin. That's Rabbi Eliezer's opinion. So again, we have three opinions. We have Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Eliezer. Let's just summarize. What did Rabbi Meir say? Rabbi Meir says that it doesn't matter if it's a shor tam or shor mu'ud. What's the din? You need a shmir ma'ula. Shmir pachus is not enough. When you're talking about a shor, you have to either close the door so then it'll withstand even a ruach she'ena mitzuya, or you have to tie it down well with a chain. But a moseir, a leash, is not enough. Rabbi Yehuda says for a shor tam it's not enough, but for a shor mu'ud it is enough. Rabbi Eliezer says it doesn't matter. When it comes to a shor mu'ud, you need a sakin. Rabbi Eliezer doesn't comment about a shor tam. We don't really know what Rabbi Eliezer would say about a shor tam, but that's not what he talks about. So shmir mula means that I'm taking into account even the.
I
think it can't be no matter what, because there's a difference between Rebbe. If it weren't for Rebbe Yezer, I would have said that. So Rebbe Yezer says no. So then there's still an onus. Right.
100 mile an hour wind, 200 mile.
Right. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe a rove. I don't know if it's like a miyah matzoi, miyah sheino matzoi. I don't know. You know, similar types of questions come up in all areas of halacha when it comes to doing what's considered a safek, what's a real safek, not a safek. So I know that, I don't know that it would apply over here, but often Rabbi Schefter has quoted, no, we quoted already, it's been a number of years, but I heard a quote, but he often used to quote the when it came to defining the concept of miut in halacha, what's considered a miut amatz, you would say 10%. 10%. So whether that applies over here or not, I don't know. But there's a certain figure that we'd have to agree upon, but there has to be a degree of... Because Rabbi Eliezer says, I don't care what shmir you do, it's not enough. So clearly, Rabbi Yehuda says, and Rameir also says, even for a tam, that we expect more than a shmir pechus, a shmir ma'ula, but if something goes wrong at that point, it's to be okay. I mean, again, I think the answer is what we call an onus. We call an onus, I think we have to come up with the probabilities for onus. If you tie the animal down with a chain, there's no way B'derech HaTeva is getting away. If a bolt of lightning comes out and knocks the chain off, the animal escapes, so then Rabbi Meir is not going to hold you responsible, nor will Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Eliezer will. Rabbi Eliezer says, this is a shor mu'ud. I told you should have killed him. You didn't listen. That's it. I don't care. I want to hear what happened. It doesn't matter. Right. That's probably what it means. I mean, what we call onus. Okay. So the Gemara says, oh, so that's Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda is the one who says the what? For a mu'ud, shmir pachus is sufficient. Oh. So the Gemara says, no. Maybe even Rabbi Meir would agree by our Mishnah. A filu tamer Rabbi Meir. Maybe that even Rabbi Meir, who says that by the shore you need a shmir mu'ud, he'd say over here it's enough. Why? Because he'll say shayni shein v'regel. Shein and regel are different; they're an exception. The haTorah mi'atah b'shmirasan, because the Torah limits already the degree of shmir that's necessary. What does that mean? The Amar Rabbi Lazar, v'Ami Lav Masnisa Tana. So Rabbi Lazar taught, for those that say that this is already taught earlier, and by a Tana, Arba Devarim haTorah mi'atah b'shmirasan. There are four different types of hezek where the Torah limits, diminishes the amount of shmir that's necessary. Ve'eluhin bor ve'esh shein v'regel. Sounds like just about everything. It's a question Pnei Yeshua asks. Why doesn't it just say there's only one thing that the Torah doesn't diminish, namely Karen? Pnei Yeshua asks that question. But the Rebbe Lazar says there are four things that the Torah already shows. You don't need to have the best foolproof shmir in the world. But the Torah is mamayit the shmir. Again, this doesn't mean that the Torah says you don't have to watch it at all, but the Torah is mamayit, which means the Torah limits the degree of shmir that's necessary. Once again, these are them. Bor, bor, esh, shein, and regel. So what we're going to do now in the Gemara is the Gemara is now going to go through each one of those and show how each one of those have somewhat of a, a limited type of shmir that's necessary. Bor, the Chassid, because the Pasuk says, Ki yiftach ish bor, o ki yichra ish bor. V'lo yechasenu. Last week when we were banging our heads, remember the pasuk goes right here. The pasuk says ki yiftach yishbor, if a person shall open a hole in the ground, meaning he'll uncover is a better way to translate this. He uncovers a previously dug pit. Oh, ki yichra ishbar, or if he digs it, v'lo yechasenu, it doesn't cover it. That's the pasuk. So Chazal comment hakisahu potter, but if he covered it, that's enough. So what do you? So what? How do you? What do you see from there?
He
doesn't have to fill it in. Says Rashi, afil porta, which means even though this is what I'm reading Rashi the way Tosos learns Rashi, because there's another way to read Rashi. The way Tosos reads Rashi is afil porta means even though covering it, not such a big deal. It's even porta literally means a little bit. It doesn't just mean you cover the whole little bit. That can't be what Rashi means. But even though covering it's not such a big deal, we don't require you to actually fill it in with dirt. That much we don't require. So the fact that a person could dig a hole in the ground, a 10-foot hole, and then what? He can then clear himself of any liability in the future by merely covering it. So that shows that the Torah limits the amount of shmira, the degree of shmira that's necessary. Because logically, one could have said, listen, you dug a hole. There's only one way that you could walk away from this with a clear conscience. That's you got to fill it in again. But covering it, that's not enough. Because if the cover gets knocked off. So again, there are different types of covers. Tosfos says, how do you know? There's a good cover. There's not such a good cover. So maybe we'll talk to Tosfos next week. Maybe we won't. But the point is, right, so it has to be sufficient enough to do something. But there's still different degrees. That was the last parak. Last parak we talked about if it can hold this, but it can't hold this animal. Okay. But it seems that Rashi is saying that any cover, even a real strong, heavy steel cover, it's still a cover. You know, it's still the mazik that you created, the way we said it last week, remember, the stifler, you created a damaging entity, that you created a bar, it still exists, it still lives, in all of its ugliness. The only thing is you covered it. So that's a miut. That's a miut that the Torah introduces regarding the Shmira that says, you know, you don't have to fill it all in. Merely covering it is enough. So we see from there that the Torah is memayit the Shmira that's necessary. Okay. Now, it's not clear yet what the chiddush of that is. You know, what's the chiddush by saying the Torah is memayit the Shmira necessary by Bor? Do we learn anything else from that? So at the moment, we don't know if we're learning anything from it, but it's an observation. What about Eish? Eish tichsev, because the pasuk says shalem yishalem hamavir asabeira ad avid kein mavir. What does this mean? So the Torah says by Eish. Again, I'm fortunate to have a Gemara that also has a pasukim on the side. So it says the whole pasuk is ki yaver ish sade. Nope, wrong pasuk. Ki seitei Eish. If the fire shall go out umatzak hotzim, and it shall ignite little twigs or sticks, v'necha gadish, and it consumes a stack of grain, oh hakama, the stalks in the field, oh asada, the field itself, shalem yishalem hamavir asabeira, that he has to pay. Who has to pay? Hamavir asabeira. Hamavir beira means the one who what? What does hamavir mean? The one who burned, the one who destroyed. Now, the truth of the matter is, we know, and this is something also we're going to talk about much more in depth later in the parak, but we know that the Torah doesn't hold you responsible for only, you know, taking a flamethrower in your hand and torching a guy's field. If I light a fire in my backyard and it's a contained fire, but I decide to leave for a couple of hours, hoping that the wind didn't blow it away, and I come back and I found that the wind took it, I'm also chayiv. Even though I'm not a what, I'm not a mavir. So what does this mean, a mavir sabeira? So you has to be. So Chazal Darshan over here, ad da'avid ke'ein mavir. It has to be ke'ein mavir. And says Rashi one word. That means pshia, meaning even by eish, you're only chayev if there was some pshia, if there was some negligence on your part. But if you light a fire, and then something out of your control comes and either starts the fire, or spreads the fire, so then you're not going to be held responsible. Is that really a chiddush? Is that a chiddush? Right. So why is that a chiddush? So maybe I would say, maybe it's a chiddush because we know that when it comes to other mamazik, it doesn't matter. You can't That's not an excuse. When it comes to other mamazik, I can't say it was an accident. It doesn't really matter. You can convince the court that it was an accident, you still have to pay. Other mu'ad liolam. So if we assume the fire is really considered, as we conclude earlier in the Vasyat, that it's like your kalach, it's like you threw an arrow, so it's sort of a chiddush that, you know, that even though it's true that when it comes to damage that is caused by your body, an onus is not a good excuse. By fire it is. By fire there has to be pshia, there has to be some real negligence on your part. You have to have been somehow careless. And so therefore we see that the Torah is memayit, that the Torah minimizes the shmira necessary by esh. So we're going to conclude here, but just to summarize, because we're sort of mid-sentence over here, but we're mid-thought, is that, we asked today, who is the Tana that holds a shmira pechus is sufficient for something which is mu'ud? And we started off saying it was Rabbi Yehuda. The Gemara is now saying, you know, maybe not. Maybe even Rabbi Meir, who says that you need that shmira pechus is good enough by Karen, even Meir who says that that you need a Shmir Ma'ula by Karen, over here, he would say that Shmir Pachut is sufficient, because there are four things that the Torah read is Mamayat the Shmir, and they are Borin Eish, and that we've seen, and we're going to get to next week a Shein V'Regel, which is going to relate back to our case. We're going to say that perhaps even Meir holds that way. So next week when we start, we'll review this last little piece over here. But the concept is over here that there are certain things that the Torah already demonstrates by example, that we don't have to throw the book at the mazik, and we can take it easy on a little bit. We don't require the fullest, most superior grade shmir.